Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Barbara Morgan, and you're listening to Austin Film Festival's On Story. This week on On Story, award-winning writer and director Brenda Chapman discusses how female perspective, a love of art, and an understanding of flawed characters influenced her writing in the animated classics The Lion King, The Prince of Egypt, and Brave. Brenda Chapman is an American writer, storyboard artist, and director. In 1998, she became the first woman to direct an animated feature from a major studio, DreamWorks Animation's The Prince of Egypt. In 2012, she co-directed the Disney Pixar film Brave with Mark Andrews, becoming the first woman to win an Academy Award for Best Animated Feature. Writer and professor Greg Garrett spoke with Chapman about her process of taking ideas from the drawing board to the screen at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King, and The Rescuers Down Under, courtesy of Walt Disney Pictures. Clips of The Prince of Egypt, courtesy of DreamWorks LLC. Clips of Brave, courtesy of Pixar and Disney Enterprises, Inc.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what you learned during your academic preparation, how that served you. And then what did you discover that you still needed to learn after you arrived at Disney?
I went to the local community college at the time. It only was a two-year program then, and then I got into CalArts. So everybody who went to CalArts wanted to be an animator because that's the person who makes all the characters move and do all of that. But I discovered at CalArts that my strength was storytelling, was actually figuring out the story and figuring out character development and who these characters were, because that's all the work that's done before the animators actually get a hold of the character and start moving them around. It's the blueprint of the film. And over the 3 years I was at CalArts, that's what I discovered. I knew what my goal was, you know, as far as what the job that I wanted would be.
You worked on some of the greatest Disney films of the 80s and 90s in one capacity or another. Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King, other things. I wonder if you could walk us through your progress as an artist and storyteller.
I started as a story trainee at Disney, and I was told when I was hired by a rather disgruntled, I forget what his title was, but I had my entrance interview with him, and he basically told me I was hired because I was a woman and because I was fresh out of school, I was good and cheap. And he had been getting flack from the new guys upstairs, which was Eisner, Katzenberg, and Frank Wells for not having any women in the creative story department or, you know, in many creative positions. So that was a little letting the air out of my balloon a little bit. But the reality was my portfolio, what I'd done at CalArts was what got me hired, noticed by the other artists at the studio who were on the review board. And so once I got past that guy, I did feel like I had to work harder than I've ever worked in my life to prove that I should stay. But at the same time, I had so much support from all those, they were all men for the most part, artists that recognized that I had something to offer. I had nearly 8 years of just these wonderful mentors, you know, and I didn't really, other than that one moment, experience any issues with being a woman in the field. But I was allowed to explore the characters. You know, I think why I brought it up was that they recognized that they didn't have a female perspective and they were starting to do these movies with female characters like Ariel and Belle and those. And so they really looked to me a lot, but they would ask, you know, sometimes the story artist would come in and say, you know, what do you think of this? Or what do you think of that? And they would listen, you know, it was great. And then I eventually worked on Rescuers Down Under and Beauty and the Beast, and each film I was able to find my sequence. On Rescuers Down Under, one of my favorite things was that I don't know how many people know the film, but there's a giant golden eagle, and in the film it doesn't speak, but for the longest time it was speaking, and it was very everyone was cringe every time because she was so regal, you know, hello, my name is Merihute, and I am the last of my kind and blah, blah, blah. You know, it was so hard. And we were all trying to figure out how to get all the exposition. But I was able to break the curse, the scene that was to give all the exposition with having the little boy after he'd saved her from the trapper's snare. She flew him up to her nest. And so I had him give most of the exposition by asking questions and getting just sort of pantomime answers or just him figuring out what she meant.
You're a mom. They're very warm. Are they gonna hatch soon? Where's the daddy eagle? Oh, my dad's gone too.
That, I think, was sort of my solid landing as an accepted story artist there, that I was able to figure that out.
Beauty and the Beast was the first animated film to get a Best Picture Oscar nomination. Was there a scene like the scene on The Rescuers where you felt like you really made a solid contribution that you felt really proud of?
Yeah, the bandaging the beast scene. They hadn't quite figured that out yet, and they just knew that Belle would fix his wounds when he came back after he saved her.
Oh, don't do that. Just hold still.
That hurts!
If you'd hold still, it wouldn't hurt as much.
Well, if you hadn't have run away, this wouldn't have happened.
If you hadn't frightened me, I wouldn't have run away.
Well, you shouldn't have been in the West Wing.
Well, you should learn to control your temper. Now hold still. This might sting a little. Mm-hmm. By the way, thank you for saving my life.
You're welcome.
You know, just playing upon who he was, it was fun to finally have the heroine actually yell at her prince, you know, and just like after he was mean to her, you know, it's just, it was a really fun scene to play. And, you know, I just wanted it to feel real.
I think maybe the last of the Disney films that I want to talk about is The Lion King. Could you talk a little bit about your work on that, what you did on that movie, and what you're particularly proud of today as you reflect back on it?
After Beauty and the Beast, I worked on development, and I was working with Mike Gabriel again, and he was looking at maybe trying to get a version of Swan Lake up and going. And so I was working really hard with him to do that. And I had, after Beauty and the Beast, felt like, you know what, I think my next step, I'd like to be a head of story. So I'd gone to the head of the studio and said, you know, if something comes up, would you mind considering me? And I was aiming for Swan Lake, and I knew Mike would probably take me on as that. And then we found out another studio was doing the Swan Princess, so they canned that. And then I was like, oh no, there was this horrible project that was in development that had been in development hell for years called King of the Jungle. And one of my closest mentors, Roger Allers, had just been asked to co-direct on that one. And I thought, oh no, Roger's going to ask me. Oh no, oh no. And of course he did. And I thought, well, I can't say no because I've thrown my name in the ring. And so the project that I had no desire to work on was the project I got asked to be on. But I consider myself professional, and so I gave it everything I had. And it was a really, really wonderful experience. And I think the ghost, Mufasa's ghost scene was the big sequence that I boarded. And I wrote a lot on that film as well. Remember who you are. Remember, remember, remember. And I remember they decided to put this scene in, and but they didn't know what Mufasa words of wisdom he would give to Simba. And I remember the scene back in Act One, where Mufasa yells at Simba for going to the elephant grave. Remember what he said. So my son, remember what I said back in Act One. Remember. So it was sort of this placeholder scene that we were going to rewrite once it was boarded, but then just the remember stuck.
Simba, you have forgotten me.
No. How could I?
You have forgotten who you are and so forgotten me. Look inside yourself, Simba. You are more than what you have become. You must take your place in the circle of life.
How can I go back? I'm not who I used to be.
Remember who you are. You are my son and the one true king. Remember who you are.
No, please, don't leave me.
Remember.
Father.
Remember.
You have silly things like that that turn into actually pretty heavy hitting scenes. And that's probably my pride and joy of that film. But just working with a lot of story artists and artists who were green, because Pocahontas was the A movie, Lion King was the B movie. And so a lot of people who wouldn't have normally gotten the chance to be leads on the project and animation and story and layout and all of these suddenly were rising to the top and really determined to do the best they could. And I think that's partly why Lion King was so successful.
Why did you leave a situation where you felt like you were valued and your voice was heard? What was in your mind when you made that transition?
Well, with the success of The Lion King, there was a bit of a shift at Disney. And suddenly we had so many executives and marketing and all of this thrown at us and kind of telling us how to do the stories, as opposed to prior to that, we were the ones leading the journey, you know, as creating the stories and deciding what was going to work and what wasn't, what was going to appeal. And so suddenly all these business people were telling us, you know, they wanted, it was very frustrating. It was starting to become very corporate. And, you know, yes, Jeffrey was part of that, but at the same time, Jeffrey was the one who had been so incredibly supportive. He convinced me to come over and try to, I was initially just going to build a story department for DreamWorks, and it was going to be more creator friendly, like it used to be at Disney. And that's what he wanted to recapture, at least in the beginning. So I went over, and then he was also the one who insisted that I become a director. You know, that was not my goal. My goal was, I felt I had my love, which was story. And I felt I was strong at that, and but he saw me moving further, and he challenged me, and eventually I succumbed, and I'd been sort of leading the development of Prince of Egypt before the eventual co-directors came on to it, because he couldn't get anyone to come over and direct this picture with such a, you know, minefield of, you know, it has God in it, you know. Yeah. You're just opening yourself up. But I don't know, after several months of leading the team, I felt like, you know, maybe I could do this. And I certainly had the support on that one to do it. So I'm glad I did. And that's why I left, was just, I think he was very enticing, you know, and on the opportunities he was offering me.
So Prenda used the word minefield in connection with Prince of Egypt. I mean, not least because, like, in all three of the Abrahamic faiths, like, this is a story that is kind of central to the tradition. This is not a traditional animated story. And in the visual look and in the actual story that you chose, I remember some interviews where you talked about we wanted to expand the possibilities and the audience for animated films. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you and your co-directors wanted to accomplish with Prince of Egypt.
We were so excited about the possibility of welcoming in an older audience. You know, Disney had done this wonderful thing for years and gave families these wonderful things, but they were mainly, you know, people saw them as films for children, even though plenty of adults love them. But yeah. But that is the stigma, for lack of a better word, of that. And so that's what we were trying to do with DreamWorks. We were trying to find the older audience.
Could you talk a little bit about where you found your story space on Prince of Egypt, and maybe also about where you felt like you brought something that your co-directors couldn't or didn't bring to that project?
As a director, I had to focus on everything. And when Simon and Steve came on, they came through Amblimation, through Spielberg's folks. So what we ended up doing was splitting up our strengths, which was mine was in story. Simon's was in animation and cinematography, and Steve's was global. He is the great organizer. So we talked about it, and I felt very strongly that we all had to be on the same page for story. And we also felt that the acting of the film, the animation, was something we all should be on board with. So we stayed together for the real storytelling part of it.
Is there a scene or an image? Like, is there something from Prince of Egypt that you're particularly proud of that you feel like you brought to that project?
There is a scene within there that all three of us, because it's such a strong scene, is where Moses, after he goes in to see Ramses, is Ramses standing over his dead son. And we cut outside and Moses collapses crying against the wall. We really fought hard for that. It, you know, no one really wanted us to do that scene, but we fought hard for that and felt if we want to continue admiring this character, he cannot leave that scene and be jubilant about taking his people away. That, you know, that's his brother's son. That's his nephew that's on that table. And so we did our best to try to keep that real. And, you know, that was something you just didn't see in an animated film at that point.
No. I once heard the novelist Amy Tan say that the more damaged the character is, the more interesting they are in terms of your story. And I've heard you talk about this a little bit. And could you talk a little bit about this idea about flaw or damage or brokenness? And some of the compelling characters that you've been involved with in your career?
It's that thing where it's the reason you follow a character through an entire hour to 2 hours is you want to see how they will conquer what it is in front of them, whether that's something inside of them or something exterior. With Belle, I mean, she has the issue of judging a book by its cover. She's only seeing them through her lens and she doesn't invite them in. You know, she just watching her with Gaston, you know, you understand why she doesn't like Gaston. That's really clear. But then once she gets to Beast and he's not what she wants him to be in the beginning, it's seeing her grow and watching another character change because of her growth. It may not always come across on the surface, but I know it's there underneath, and that's really speaking to an audience. You know, I think Simba's obvious. He's growing up, you know, and he's learning to become a responsible adult, basically, you know, and has to go through some pretty awful things to get there. But with Moses and Ramesses, it was a very different way because we had this story that was already very set in stone, pardon the pun. And so we had to find that thing, you know, that brother's story is both their weakness and their strength. And that played very well for that story throughout. And for Merida and Brave, it was, you know, she was having to grow up, but stubborn and wanting what she wanted, but wasn't listening, you know, to what, what she needed to hear. But then again, neither was mother, you know, on some levels, you know, that they needed to listen to each other to actually be able to come together and understand each other. So, you know, finding those weaknesses that the characters have or the flaws, that to me is the key to what your plot is eventually going to be.
You have often talked about how your relationship with your daughter, who's now in her 20s. In an interview, you said stories, and I quote, usually come from personal experience. Just something in my life that touched me, or a strong memory, or a strong emotional connection, and I go from there. Could you tell us more about where in your films you've used material from your own life to tell these powerful stories?
I go back to the scene in Rescuers Down Under with the little boy at the nest. I pulled that from my childhood watching. There was a little live action short that Roy Disney Jr. Had done about a little boy with an eagle. And I haven't seen it in years, but it was this little boy who was always bullied by these other little Native American kids. And he ends up having this relationship with this eagle. And then in the end, he turns into the eagle and flies off. You know, it so impacted me. And when we were doing that, I just remembered that and how strong that was. And I tried to take that essence and put it into that scene. And that's why that ended up being that way. And Beauty and the Beast, it's like I have three older brothers and an older sister. And if they were like yelling at me, you know, I learned to yell back because I was the youngest. It was like I had to stand up for myself. And it's like, so, you know, people were not talking to me well, so that's what Belle was. But if you imbue something with something that was real from your inner being, you know, that will come off as sincere on film.
So in the opening scene of Brave, Fergus gives Merida a bow and arrows. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your struggle to try and create that character for Brave. And maybe I'll park this over here, but I would love to hear where you think animated features are now in their depiction of women. But just let's start with Disney princesses and kind of roll from there.
You know, I mean, I felt like we had gone a long way with Ariel and Belle from Snow White and Sleeping Beauty. You know, they didn't have a lot going on upstairs other than waiting for their prince. And, you know, I never related to Snow White. I like the dwarves, but, you know, there's been a lot of criticism of Belle and Ariel about, you know, their main goal was getting a man. And I'd say Belle just wanted a bigger life and got thrown into this situation. And Ariel, she was proactive. And Belle, one of the criticisms is of the Stockholm syndrome, but I disagree with that. I think she went in and sacrificed herself to save her father, and she wasn't having anything. The Beast didn't pull her into his way of life. She actually changed him. But again, she ends up with the guy, and that's the goal. And I totally get that. And so with Merida, I just wanted to turn it all on her ear and just say, okay, this is a real princess of a semi-real kind of time where they were grittier, but they were also used as tools to keep peace among warring kingdoms. You know, they would be married off to make these links. And so I wanted to put a little of that reality in there with, you know, this impending marriage thing, but also having her show that, no, I'm a warrior. I can stand up for I can be who I need to be. You know, I am my own person, but yet honor, you know, the history of how things kind of were. So I was trying to find that balance and also showing a strong queen being a diplomat, learning how to navigate those waters and show that there are other ways to do this other than war. The main thing was to really show a different kind of princess.
And I remember that one of your fights is with the marketing people who wanted to redesign Merida and her body type and make her one of these sort of big-eyed anime Disney princesses.
Oh, it was very frustrating. And by then, you know, I was not at Pixar any longer. And I felt like I'd handed them this opportunity. Here's a new thing for these young girls who want more, that are searching and they don't see it, you know, the athletes, and just the smart girls who, you know, want a smart role model. And it was just very frustrating because everything they did to Merida was the exact thing she hated in the film.
What guides you as you work on something new?
I love the combination of heart. I have to be able to feel the true soul and heart in a project. I love magic. I love whimsy. I love period pieces. It's like I'm brave. It's always my thing was my three loves, which was fairy tales, Scotland, but mostly my daughter. You know, it's just having those things that I can really hang on to.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and the National Endowment for the Arts, on the web at arts.gov. Support for On Story comes from Bogle Family Vineyards, sixth-generation farmers and third-generation winemakers, creating sustainably grown wines that are a reflection of the Bogle family values since 1968. This show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Jamal Knox and Colin Heyer. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from Sound Lab, Inc., Travis Kennedy Sound, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.